from the Guinness Virgin and 91.1 WCBT Gettysburg. I'm Ben Ponce, and this is On Target.
I'm Gari Mangala, and today on Target we will be discussing the 15th president of Gettysburg College.
Then we'll sit down with Associate Professor of Health Sciences Amy Daly to discuss food insecurity in Adams County. Stay with us. All right, well, let's get into it. Some major news this week, Gari. We have a new president-elect.
We do.
Tell us about it.
Robert Iuliano, he is the new president and will start July 1st after Janet Morgan-Rank's retirement. He is originally from Massachusetts and has worked at Harvard for the last 25 years. He went to Harvard and then came back in 94 and started working in the office of the general counsel, where he was working in development projects to, I guess, benefit the student body in a lot of ways. He worked with Greek Life and developed a new ROTC program that had been on hiatus for 40 years after some Vietnam War era protests. He also has worked in diversity and inclusion, though, you know, there's a little bit of conversation about which way was he working.
He was heavily involved on Harvard's President's Commission on Inclusion and Belonging.
Mm-hmm.
He's also been as general counsel of Harvard. It's worth noting, by the way, that this is a lawyer. He's not been in any sort of tenured or tenure track faculty position. He's taught a handful of classes. Currently, he's teaching a freshman seminar at Harvard, having something to do with higher education and current issues. But in any case, he is someone that is not the stereotypical professorial route towards becoming a college president like Janet Morgan Riggs.
Which is something that was discussed as a possibility earlier last semester. Charlie Scott was talking about how maybe we won't go the education route. Technically, I mean, Iuliano is coming from an educational background. You know, he's worked at a college. He knows how to admin for a college. But he, like you were saying, does not come from a professor background. I know we were talking earlier, maybe it would be somebody from a business, like, big corporation.
Seems like they kind of went a hybrid route.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that he has seen kind of the best of both worlds, both like in and out of the educational field. And maybe that's something that could benefit us. You know, he's not completely immune to understanding what it's like to work at a college, but, you know, he's also seen the rest of the world. There's also the conversation about, you know, Harvard is a very large school with a very different demographic in a lot of ways. We were talking about, you know, how much money he's brought in for their capital campaign, $9.6 billion. And if you compare it directly, just apples to apples to Gettysburg, it looks like he's made a lot more money. But also, let's talk about the fact that it's Harvard versus Gettysburg College.
Right.
And if he's going to, you know, understand what it's like to work at a liberal arts school, for the most part, Gettysburg is going to be a different beast than Harvard. And he's going to have to learn a lot of different things about the college for better or for worse.
Right.
And I know that was a fear for students. You know, JMR is born and bred Gettysburg. She came here for undergrad and has worked here and became president. And she was a really good fit. And I've not heard many complaints, or if any, about JMR's tenure here. And obviously, I think everyone's going to be excited, maybe anxious, to see how he takes on a very new community to him, a community that is very used to knowing a lot and seeing a lot of our president. I know he said in his introductory video on the YouTube page for Gettysburg College, you know, come up to me, say hi to me. They even put his wife there, which I think is a good sign. The wife, and or in this case the husband, for JMR's sake, has always been pretty involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, Janet and Ed Riggs were friends in college, and they got married, and of course, so Ed Riggs is an alum and he's coached here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, certainly what we have here is a different context wherein, as near as, you know, we can tell, Iuliano really has no background at or connection to Gettysburg College. What was interesting to me was how much all of the endorsements that came out. And so the college released quotes from all of the members of the search committee, and Dave Brennan, the chair of the Board of Trustees, Lawrence Bacall, excuse me, who is the president, current president of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust, who is a Civil War historian who has been to Gettysburg College many times and was the previous president of Harvard, as well as Janet Morgan Riggs, and all of the endorsements. Now, what I think, obviously, no one's going to say something negative or anything negative, but what I think is telling is what they choose to talk about in their little snippet endorsement, and they all, almost without fail, mentioned his deep commitment to the liberal arts. Harvard is a major research university, not a liberal arts college. He went to law school at UVA, which is University of Virginia, which is another huge state school. And so it's interesting to me, and one thing that we'll want to ask him is where this commitment to the liberal arts came from. And you know, maybe it's something that he's been looking to do for a long time and hasn't been able to do at Harvard. Maybe that's part of the reason as to why, you know, why you'd leave Harvard to go to a liberal arts college like Gettysburg. But it's interesting to me, and just on paper, I was surprised to see that someone who is the number two or number three, you know, certainly a senior level reporting directly to the president at Harvard, wanted to leave and come to Gettysburg. And you know, my first thought cynically was what scandal is going on that he's jumping ship over. And I mean, as general counsel, certainly he's involved in some of the pending litigation and the major two pieces of litigation going on right now. And we'll talk about these. Let's talk about these now. Is one, a lawsuit about Harvard's admissions practices from a group called Students for Fair Admissions. It's a group representing Asian students who were denied admission because they did not. Well, they're alleging that Asian students were systematically discriminated against and would have had to achieve at a higher rates than other ethnic groups to get in. So essentially, this is a challenge to the legality of affirmative action. And so there's a judge, the case has been argued, the judge is still waiting to rule, a ruling could happen at any time now. So that's one. And Harvard's position has been, yes, affirmative action is crucial to building diversity in classes, and that's the position he's been arguing. But what's interesting is that the challenge to affirmative action has been coming from a racial minority.
Yeah.
The other piece of litigation that I think has also piqued the interest of the Gettysburg campus is that Harvard has not ended, not eliminated, but has curtailed and disincentivized students from participating in single-sex organizations, including not solely, but perhaps predominantly fraternities. And so the rationale there, I think, had a lot to do with, you know, some of the same things we talk about with the Greek system here at Gettysburg. And so the way that Harvard has kind of gone about disincentivizing students is saying you can, we can't stop you from being a member of an off-campus organization, which is what they are, but we will not, you cannot hold any leadership positions on campus, nor will we nominate you for any of the big national scholarships like a Truman or Marshall or Rhodes or anything like that if you're a member of one of these organizations? And so there's a group that is suing to say that that is not legal. And so that's kind of the, those are the two big current pieces of pending litigation that he has, as general counsel, not been arguing in court, but certainly he's been crafting a legal strategy.
Absolutely.
And the institutional response.
Yeah, back to just jumping back a little bit quickly to the point you were talking about liberal arts. You know, this is a college. Yeah, all at like all admissions processes are going to embellish the truth. But one thing that I think has been really important is the attention that faculty have towards their students. You know, the ratio, I think, is 9 to 1 here, something like that.
That sounds about right. I mean, it's low.
It's low, definitely. And that's not something you're going to see at Harvard. We don't have big lecture halls where any professor doesn't know your name. I've gotten emails from bigger classes asking where I was in class before. You know, like, this is a school where faculty know their students know their faculty, and we like it that way. And beyond that, I've also spoken to faculty members who've always spoken about the fact that they like the fact that they are educators and teachers first and they are researchers second. They're not being forced to do research at the expense of their classroom. And that's something that, you know, I have not spent time at Harvard. I don't know what I can say about that, but obviously that's not going to be the case at such a big research school. And wondering how that's going to affect the way professors are asked to conduct research, how they're asked to publish, how often they're asked to publish. If this is just going to change the way that we look at the liberal arts school, if, you know, the way that Giuliano loves the liberal arts and is a champion of the liberal arts, is that the same model of a liberal arts thing as we see?
Yeah, and I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, certainly it is the case that to get tenure, you are expected to research here at Gettysburg, and in
Definitely.
Fact, you know, I can say, and not because we're withholding this, but just because you don't want to do any disservice to anyone, two faculty members did not get tenure this cycle at Gettysburg, and it had to do with research output by all accounts. And so, you know, it certainly is something that is taken seriously here. That said, you're right that, you know, faculty teach five classes a year here, whereas at school, at a big research school, you teach one or two maybe. And so, you know, it's a different dynamic. Certainly it's a different institutional context. That said, Harvard has the reputation of being Harvard because it's Harvard.
That's, I think, honestly, anyone who knows literally anything about Harvard would agree with that sentence.
Next Friday, February the 8th at 3 o'clock p.m., the Gettysburgian will be hosting an interview with President-elect Giuliano. It'll be streamed on Facebook via Facebook Live. There's talk that we might be able to get it aired live here on WZBT for all of you avid community listeners who want to listen on your radio Friday, February the 8th at 3 o'clock p.m. If you aren't able to catch it then, or if we aren't able to get it on the radio then, you'll certainly be able to find it on Gettysburgian.com, our website, and we'll likely air parts of it or the whole thing, who knows, next week on Target.
Yeah, and we on the website we have a Google form, so we only have 25 minutes with Giuliano, but Ben's not the only one who should be able to ask him questions. So if you have
as
any,
insightful as I'm sure my questions will be.
Of course. But if there's something that you're concerned about that maybe you want to know more about, this is an opportunity to have his ear in a way and also hear what he has to say. Beyond that, this same night, February 8th, that's a Friday, if I'm correct, Ben?
February 8th is a Friday, yes.
Yep. So around 7 p.m., there will be a community introduction of Robert Giuliano to the college. So if that's something that interests you, I think everyone on the campus should be there to introduce him to our community.
I believe in the past you've said something like, go to things that are important to you.
If it matters to you, do it.
Speaking of things that matter, let's go to, I guess we'll make a confession that at this point we had to re-record this part of the DPS. The next story we're going to talk about
You're
is about DPS.
Ben.
Yeah, no, we had a bit of a technical glitch the first time, and I used that ridiculous little segue the first time and decided I was going to use it again. So in any case, speaking of things that matter, this week on Monday evening, the Gettysburg College Executive Director of Public Safety, Bill Lafferty, and Dean of Students, Julie Ramsey, presented to the Student Senate a proposal to situationally arm DPS officers. And I think it's worth noting at the top, one, that DPS is not a sworn police department. It's a private security agency whose jurisdiction extends to the boundaries, but no further than the boundaries of campus. And so that's one. Two is that Pennsylvania's Act 235 allows such private security agencies to be armed on their property to defend that property and its occupants. And so there's a training regimen that is prescribed there. That training includes 40 hours, I believe, of classroom work. And then there's some other components to it. It has to be renewed every 5 years. 12 officers already have that training. DPS currently has tasers. They've had them since 2010. In that time, it's worth noting that they've never used them, which has led some to wonder why, if you haven't needed tasers in the last 9 years, why you would need guns. But, you know, it's another point of view there might be that they've exercised that much restraint, then you know, you hope they would never use the guns. Obviously, this is not an endeavor, and it's worth, maybe it's not obvious. It's a distinction worth noting as well that we're not talking about them being armed every day.
Yeah, absolutely not.
And so, Gari, walk through kind of the situations under which they would be armed.
So, providing a little bit more context, this has been a conversation happening with Dean Ramsey, Bill Lafferty, and President Riggs, and I'm sure a few other people involved since the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre, which I think changed a lot of ways that we, like, bigger buildings and communities have been looking at their security, specifically colleges and universities. And as we hear more and more stories, I think more and more communities have been thinking about that. Movie theaters, elementary schools. It's just something that in the 21st century you have to be thinking about. So every year, Dean Ramsey and Bill Lafferty discuss the situation of security procedures, and they make a recommendation to President Riggs or whoever will be president. So if this continues after this, it will go to President Iuliano and discuss the situations of in what that have happened in the last year and if we think we need to arm DPS in any situation. This is the first year that that has been discussed, and that's the first year that this has been a proposal that's been created, and that's why it was brought to the Student Senate. There's been, I believe, like four instances over the last year that Bill Lafferty cited where he thought that there could be a need for DPS to be armed. A lot of this comes from the fact that, you know, it's been harder and harder, especially since 2017, to get support from police officers that are under oath that do carry GPD, but also the National Park Service, Cumberland Township Police, and even Pennsylvania State Police to support the campus community, especially when we have bigger, large-scale open-air events on campus, so graduation, but also 2 years ago when Robert Spencer came, you know, we had support then, but there's the question of will we have support if that happened again.
Right, and so what we're talking about here is not that there is an emergency on campus mm-hmm. and local police can't respond. It's, you know, if there's one of these large-scale events, or I think another scenario that's been mentioned is if there's, you know, a rally of some kind going on in town that we're concerned could spill over onto campus, local police resources are going to be strained to deal with that as opposed to, you know, supporting DPS.
Absolutely.
And so the answer in the past when DPS had asked for that kind of armed support had typically been yes, but now that's been more tenuous, is what Bill Lafferty is saying. And so he wants his own officers to be prepared for those sorts of situations.
And Dean Ramsey and Bill Lafferty at the Senate meeting were even speaking about how when school is in session, the campus and the community here at Gettysburg College specifically makes up a big part of the town. And while GPD wants to be everywhere at once, especially when something like Antifa or the KKK or somebody comes to town, but they need to handle things there, but they also want to support the campus. So it's what can you do if we don't have people that can be everywhere? Ben, we've talked a little bit about that there's other reasons why GPD isn't being as organized.
Yeah,
you want to talk about that?
So GPD, we're referring to Gettysburg Borough Police here, has had some staffing issues of its own. They've had some unfilled positions, and they've been acting without a permanent chief since June of 2018. Theoretically, someone will be in by March. But, you know, that's been kind of one of the reasons that they've been less able to support campus with those types of things, is that there's a, you know, staffing issues over there. And so it's interesting to know that many current DPS officers are former local police officers, and so they've already been through a lot of this training. It's also worth noting that Bill Lafferty has said that based on his own military experience and law enforcement experience, he would only be comfortable with this proposal if there were the extra training that he is proposing, and that would include twice a semester having officers out on the range, and then also a semesterly presentation from a firearms guru of some sort. That's actually the term he used. He was drawing a blank on the official term, but there's a list from the state police as far as, you know, people qualified to administer this type of training who would come to campus on a semesterly basis. And then, of course, every 5 years, the legal certification is required. So, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here. You know, Gari, I think one thing that you mentioned, and the Gettysburgian, I should note, did a staff editorial on this, and we came out in support With some reservations. And talk about some of the reservations, that not just the Gettysburgian has put forward, but that the campus community, that people you've talked to have discussed.
Yeah, I think one thing is just, I think that was like maybe the beginning of the editorial, was you just need to look online or look on the TV, and you're hearing stories of things with guns going wrong. Personally, I think that while you can call it a tool, you can call it a weapon, you can call it whatever it is, it does have the power to take a life. And I think that's something that needs to be taken into account. I know that during Student Senate, one person brought up, well, if we're in a situation now that DPS has this as access, what happens if there's a situation where there's no weapons involved, there's a fight going on in a frat? And I think a lot of that concern came from the fact, not that we don't trust the DPS officers, but if there's a bunch of, I don't know, drunk 20-year-olds around one or two guys that have guns, that could go really wrong if it did. So, and Bill Lafferty assured that if there's not a situation involving a gun, it's not going to be met with the force of a gun, which kind of settled, I think, a lot of tension there. But people are bringing up, you know, at the end of the day, if there's a gun involved and there's some bias or there's some fear or something goes wrong, the consequences of a taser, and tasers haven't been used, but a consequence of a taser is going to be very different and very minimal compared to the consequences of a gun. And I think students, specifically those who come from backgrounds where they've seen gun violence in their lives, are reasonably concerned about it. Eric Cabrera, who is a senator, spoke about this at the Student Senate meeting and then also commented to the Gettysburgian in one of, I think, the article that you wrote, Ben, about the situational arming, you know, discussing his experiences in Mexico where he grew up, and talking about, you know, he would be in school and there's not really much you can do, because if it's so normal to hear the gun violence happening outside from gangs and drug lords, like, there's not much you can do about it. And he was asking for, you know, more training on the part of the students of what to do. Bill Lafferty was giving a presentation and discussing, you know, what the students are taught to do about, like, run, hide, fight, and things like that. But we don't really have that much training. We talk about it at orientation, our first year here, and then we have the alerts that go out on our phones and our emails, and then we have days where we're told not to leave class for a couple of minutes while they're just trying to make sure that a lockdown happens. But we don't really talk about active shooter protocol for the most part. We don't have training that we did. I know my high school, we had a lot of active training.
Well, yeah, that's another thing that Julie Ramsey said, is that a lot of students come to Gettysburg from high schools where there were armed, you know, a school resource officer or something of that nature, so that they're surprised to learn that DPS is not armed, you know. And I think that there is an assumption, it's probably an assumption that I had, that, you know, oh, DPS isn't armed? That's odd.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, it's a change, but it's not a change that I think will surprise.
I know that
it's a change to what would not surprise people, I
absolutely,
guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I do remember talking to Bill Lafferty a year ago. I think we were just talking about protocol in general for something I was writing. And I remember him telling me that international students, specifically those who come from countries where, like, this isn't the done thing. I think American students are just kind of used to this because it's on our televisions all the time. But that's not the case in every country. Not to say that every country, like, doesn't have their own problems, but, like, gun violence is just a very done thing here, unfortunately.
American phenomenon.
Yeah. And he was telling me that before those students kind of go through their normal orientation process that you and I went through, he does sit down with them and he does discuss, like, what to do, because they are not coming from these American schools where, you know, you've been trained on how to deal with an active shooter protocol before you knew how to tie your shoes, which is, like, a dark thing to think, but also seems kind of necessary in today. You know, we used to cram in like sardines, and then I remember when a lot of schools changed from those protocols to run, hide, fight. And I remember talking about how some students have not done the run, hide, fight. I came from a school where we were still being packed in sardines, like sardines, until I graduated. I don't really think they've changed that protocol. So I think Eric's point, and I think a lot of people talking about, regardless of how DPS is trained with the guns, if we're talking about there ever being a situation where there's someone on campus who can have a gun, and if, like, that's something that's being suggested, regardless of how this proposal goes through, that's something that I think needs to happen. You know, I know it's hard just because everyone's busy or whatever, but I think safety is important. And I think that, you know, if it's during a class time or kids are in class, like if you're at home, maybe you don't have to participate just because, like, that's what you where you would be. But I think sending out an alert saying active shooter drill and having that run, I think that that would make a lot of sense maybe to do that yearly. If that's something that we're discussing now. And while for the most part, this entire proposal is circulating around just these events that happen on campus and it's more just like a security measure, it wasn't like that wasn't brought up. Like active shooter situations were brought up at the Student Senate meeting, and that is definitely a contributor to everything that's happening.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the process really quickly moving forward. So this presentation happened right now. Ramsey and Lafferty are gathering information to make a recommendation to the president. They hope to make that recommendation in March, and then President Riggs will presumably hear that. And they are, I did ask specifically about whether it will be President Riggs that makes this call, and the answer was yes.
Yeah.
By it is intended that President Riggs will be the one to make this final decision. And if it were to be adopted, they'd train over the summer, and then this protocol would be in place beginning in the fall. It's also worth noting that the proposal would require the president, the executive vice president, the dean of students, and or the director of DPS to authorize getting the guns from the gun safe at DPS, you know, for any situation. And so that it's not that every officer would have that discretion.
I would be interested to see, like, if this proposal went through. This is hypothetical, but, like, if the proposal goes through and then Giuliano comes in and just is completely against it, how that would go down.
Yeah, it's worth noting he was the head of the Harvard University Police Department.
Yeah,
they have
he
a
was.
Police department there, so you would assume that he would be on board with this.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to wrap up our news segment. We'll be right back with the Bullet Report and then our interview with Associate Professor of Health Sciences, Amy Daly. Stay with us. It's time for the Bullet Report. It's been a fairly exciting week in Gettysburg College sports action. On January the 26th, the men's wrestling team lost to Johns Hopkins 23-21. They lost to Washington and Lee 29-12 the same day. The men's swimming team defeated Mary Washington 158-104, while the women lost 149-112. The women's basketball team lost to Haverford 59-38. The men lost 75-53, capping off a fairly losing day on the 26th. The losing continued on January the 30th when the men's basketball team fell to FNM 58-54, but the women's basketball team defeated Franklin and Marshall 77-66 the same day. The wrestling team lost to Ursinus 26-13 earlier today. That's February the 2nd. The men's wrestling team defeated Muhlenberg, however, 29-20. The swimming team lost to Swarthmore 135.5 to 126.5, while the women lost 134 to 128. Also to Swarthmore. The women's basketball team defeated Swarthmore 75-54, while the men's team lost to Swarthmore 99-60. Thus endeth the Bullet Report. We'll be right back with Amy Daly. And we're thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Amy Daly, an associate professor of health sciences here at Gettysburg College. Dr. Daly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
So why don't we start here? You're a social epidemiologist. In layperson's terms, could you talk about what that entails?
Sure. So epidemiology in general is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease and health outcomes. So I look at patterns of disease and health outcomes, and then I try to also think about what contributes to those patterns. And then ultimately in public health, we're interested in how do you actually solve some of those problems and come up with policies and programs to address those patterns.
Right. And so among kind of the recent areas of your research has been food insecurity in Adams County. So could you talk a little bit first about how you kind of got into that particular topic? You said before we just started that you've now been at Gettysburg for 9 years. So talk a little bit about how you started in that particular field and then maybe some top level findings since you've been that, and then we'll kind of drill deeper as we go on.
Sure. So I didn't actually address the social part of the epidemiology in the answer to my last question. So I study social determinants of health. And so I study factors economics, income, wealth, discrimination, access to resources, all of those social determinants of health that are important besides just sort of your individual decisions that you make in terms of health outcomes. And so my dissertation work and early work before I came to Gettysburg was really centered around racial discrimination and gender discrimination and how that influences access to healthcare. And then when I came to Gettysburg, I really wanted to do more community-based participatory research. And so I started working with the Center for Public Service. I got involved with some of the local organizations here. I sit on the Adams County Food Policy Council. And one of the primary goals of that council is to address food insecurity in this community. And so I was able to just sort of step in and figure out what it was that this community needs and wants and how I could contribute to something that was already ongoing. So This community has been very welcoming to me, and it's been great to work with community organizations and students and bring it all together.
I was going to say, if you look at any one of your papers, you can see, you know, there are like 7 or 8 authors and all the organizational affiliations. So certainly that you're working with a cross-section of organizations. And I know that one of the recent projects that you've been working on is relating to increasing fruit and vegetable consumption among, I guess, populations that access SNAP and other nutritional assistance programs. So could you talk a little bit about first kind of the broad scope of what that program and what you've kind of looked at and done so far and what you found since doing that?
So again, back to the Food Policy Council, one of the goals is to make sure that people are able to access healthy and affordable food here. And as you know, we live in a very agricultural community. And so we have a lot of growers. It's winter right now, so not as much growing going on right now, but a lot of local work going on around food and food access and farmers markets. And so we also have a population that lives in what we call the food gap or the wage gap, where you might not make quite enough money to have affordable, healthy food for your family. So one of our first programs that we've been working on for probably almost the whole time that I've been here is called Healthy Options. And this is for folks that actually don't qualify for SNAP, which is the federal program for food assistance. And so that could be because they make a little bit too much money to actually qualify, or for immigration status sort of documentation issues. There are people in this community who don't qualify for food assistance. And so the goals of that program are sort of twofold. How do we get healthy, affordable food more available to people who need it, but also how do we support our local growers?
And thinking a little bit more about the SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, How does your research and your takeaways from that, specifically the demographics surrounding the food gap and the wage gap, transfer nationwide, and what makes Adams County an interesting place to look at this research?
Well, I think the fact that we do have this Food Policy Council that's been in existence for a decade now, it's been recognized as one of the early food policy councils, particularly in a rural area. And so we have programs for people that are on SNAP as well that we've gotten some grant money from the USDA. So the USDA chose our community to pilot a program called Fruit and Vegetable Bucks, where we partner with Kenny's, which is the local supermarket here, for people on SNAP to have more access to fruits and vegetables. And so it's helped us to locally kind of think about how do we partner with other organizations outside of just social service agencies. Mm-hmm. But I think it really hopefully is a model for other communities trying to do this kind of work as well.
And in the obviously, Adams County is not the only place facing these issues of household poverty and food insecurity in the U.S. Based on your findings, do you think the Healthy Options Initiative is a probable applicant to the nation?
Potentially. I mean, I think that I still struggle with the idea of how do we actually think about more of policy that's really related to wages. And I think that trying to fix a problem with programs, and let's be real, it's like $40 or $50 a month that it's given to families. I don't think necessarily a long-term solution, but something that we're trying to do as a community to help make sure that families have a little bit more. But I think nationwide and sort of big policy level answers probably lie in sort of bigger economic policies.
In the Healthy Options Program, in your particular, your follow-up paper reported that 55% of participants reported an increase in fruits and vegetable consumption at the end of the program. Given that these were vouchers directly towards buying fruits and vegetables, is that number low? Is that satisfactory?
I think anytime you can see improvements in behaviors is a time to celebrate, because what we know in public health is it's extremely difficult to change individual behaviors. And so if anything you can do to sort of change the environment or have more access, we know that where you live and what you have access to is more important to health outcomes than sort of that individual decision-making that goes on in terms of healthy eating and physical activity and all those things that we typically think of in terms of the health realm. And so I think anytime that you can see an improvement, I mean, you would want to know if there were long-term improvements in health behaviors as well, but we have seen some really good positive outcomes with these programs for sure.
You've mentioned a few times the Food Policy Council in Adams County. What are some of the longer-term projects that group's working on? And, you know, what are kind of the next steps for here in Adams County? And you've also mentioned that the USDA has looked at Adams County as maybe a model for some broader things. What are kind of the next steps that you're looking at?
Well, I think what's exciting with what's going on now is that there are a lot more conversations between policy councils happening. And so there's a lot more exchange of information. Right now, Pennsylvania is trying to come up with a statewide food policy kind of plan and regional food policy councils. And this is a nationwide trend with food policy councils. And so I think that now we're seeing sort of a synergy happening across the councils. And so in terms of long-term projects, we're still interested in making sure that we can support programs that provide or at least increase access to healthy food. But again, we're interested in supporting our local growers. We're also thinking about what those health outcomes are related to the health assessment. So we know that it's not just low-income families who don't get enough fruits and vegetables into their diet. The latest health assessment data shows that only 4% of Adams County residents actually have 3 servings of vegetables a day. And, you know, probably is a lot for most people to think of having 3 vegetables a day. But, you know, according to nutrition guidelines, that's a good benchmark. And pretty much nobody in the county is actually reaching that. So I think that there's still plenty of work to do in the county.
Yeah. And so aside from income, what are some of the other barriers that that the data that you're talking about has found to, you know, not just fruits and vegetables, but to healthy eating in general and to sufficient eating in general. I mean, I'm just thinking, is transportation to grocery stores or to, like, that seems like it could be an issue in an area as spread out as Adams County can be.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other issues and barriers?
Yeah, so I think that you're spot on there thinking that it's not just about food, right? All of these big social determinants are connected to each other. So low wages, transportation, housing actually is a crisis here in Adams County. So
that
was
the next thing I was going to ask.
Many people have been coming together in the county to talk about housing and how do we get more developers to build more affordable housing options. Gettysburg is a fairly expensive place to live and relatively speaking, and so people have to go farther and farther out to be able to find affordable housing. And then, like you said, transportation becomes an issue. We have a large migrant population as well in terms of thinking about barriers to transportation and getting places. Those are the big ones that I can think of.
Talk a little bit more about that housing initiative. I was just yesterday, I met with Megan Shreve from SCAP, and we were talking about this housing issue. And she had mentioned that kind of a lot of agencies in Adams County are coming together on this issue of housing. Could you talk a little bit about those efforts?
Yeah, well, I have not been as involved in the last few months, but I did have a student working with me a couple of years ago on just looking at housing vouchers. So if you need housing assistance, oftentimes people have to stay on that list for about a year before a voucher becomes available. And then what is really troubling is that people often have difficulty actually finding a place to rent even after they've gotten one of those housing vouchers that provides assistance from the government to help them pay for rent. And so part of that is that there's just not a lot of housing available here in Gettysburg, and it's not terribly affordable when it is available. And so there are a lot of hoops that landlords have to go through in order to qualify for accepting assistance vouchers. So that's another barrier, I think. And so that's one of the areas that I was interested in looking into is just how much assistance available for low-income families. But middle-income families are struggling to find places that are affordable here in this area, too. And then, again, that links back to the transportation issues because, as you know, there's not a whole lot of transportation available in this area. So if you have to go too far out of Gettysburg, if your job is here, then it becomes another barrier.
Right. And so maybe kind of tying all of this back to public policy and to public health in particular, I know that you're on the public policy committee here at the college and that, you know, a lot of your research has tied back to that. Earlier you mentioned that, local solutions are likely only to get so far that maybe broader, you mentioned a statewide initiative earlier or federal economic policy. If you had a magic wand, what is one thing that you would like to kind of think about that could move the needle on some of these food insecurity issues that we talked about earlier in the interview?
Well, I'm not an economist or a policy analyst. So in my mind, I think it is very much related to how we support people that are making low wages, because people are working and they're working hard and they're just not able to make ends meet. So whatever policy we could do, whether that's at the local level, I tend to focus my research efforts. I see Gretchen Natter walking by. I have a position with the Center for Public Service here as well as the Director of Community-Based Learning and Research. And so I tend to focus my efforts at the local level. But I think that what we see here locally is very much related to people are working, they're working hard and still not being able to make ends meet. And it's hard to live a healthy life if you're worried about paying rent and if you're worried about putting food on the table. And, you know, the primary the primary ways that people, you know, get money in this area are related to things like agriculture and tourism. And so how do we actually support the work, all the hard work that's done in this community and all over the country with policies that support people to be able to be self-sustaining, because that's what people ultimately want to be, right?
Yeah. And sort of at that local level, as you've been kind of working at this, what are some of the most pressing, what are the most challenging barriers that are kind of slowing progress, and what are kind of some of the next steps that you're looking at the local level in terms of policy?
Well, one of the things that I've been working on with several organizations in the community is how do we come together to actually make sure we have a common narrative around the research and data that we know about this community. So how do we share information, whether it's health information or program evaluation data, so that we're not perpetuating stereotypes and things, but actually having a shared narrative about what the issues are in this community that organizations are working on. But then how do we more effectively communicate that information and that data? And how can we work together on research projects? As I said before, I'm interested in community-based participatory research. So I don't consider any of this research that I do my research. It's our research. So mm-hmm. One of the things that's important in terms of those principles is how do you generate research questions and thinking about dissemination of those results in partnership with community members, and then it's not just driven by faculty members.
And one thing you just mentioned that jogged something else I wanted to ask about. Earlier this week, I know you presented on some data that is now available. I know that there are several other kind of installments of that data. Could you talk a little bit about this data?
So we have a 5-series workshop.
That's a really specific question. Talk about this data.
We have a 5-series data presentation workshop series that we are putting together with these partners I was just talking about. And I'm doing this actually in conjunction with my statistics for health sciences course this semester. So I'm teaching a lab of that course. And so we're working with organizations to think about how do we communicate some of that local data. So my students are learning, you know, how to do infographics and actually to present data in ethical, authentic ways, working with community organizations. So we just had our first workshop that Kathy Gaskin from Healthy Adams County and Gretchen Carlson Natter and I led on Wednesday, I guess it was. So mostly we talked about the health assessment data that has been published in the past year. The community has to do these health assessments every 3 years. It's a federally mandated assessment process. That uses state level data. And then also there's a local survey, a behavioral risk factor surveillance system survey that's done. And so we talked about some of that data. So we talked about the top priorities in Adams County as led by Healthy Adams County. And those three priorities are overweight and obesity, mental health, and then housing, as we've been talking about. And so we have 4 more coming up. Everyone is invited. They're public. They're in Cub 260 on a particular Wednesday afternoon. So the next one coming up is called Youth Voice. So we'll be looking at data collected in this community from adolescents and hearing from them. And then we're going to have some information from planning and development, from folks in education. And then Megan Shreve, who you brought up earlier, is going to be talking about living on low wages here in Adams County.
Yeah. And so then maybe as kind of a final question, you know, folks who listen to this, they either listen on the radio, so there are some community members that, in fact, I ran into a community member who asked if I was the person who hosts that podcast the other day. And then there are also some students. And so I think a lot of people hear about these issues, relating to public health or even public policy more generally. And there's kind of this, boy, you'd like to do something about that, but you don't know where to start. So, or you don't feel like one person's, you know, interest in this is going to actually affect anything. What would you say to someone who's interested in these issues as far as a, maybe even just a first step towards getting involved on whether it's food policy or anything else that you've brought up?
Well, for the Food Policy Council, we have open meetings. The first, I'm going to mess this up, it's the first Wednesday of every month, I believe. And also, Healthy Adams County has at least 12 task forces that are also open meetings that people can get involved with. And then we often have different kinds of forums around the community. So there have been conversations around housing in particular that have been going on over the last few months. There's a housing summit coming up at the end of March. That is totally open to the public.
Yeah, Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted, is coming to that.
Yes. So that will be exciting. So I think this is it's an interesting community that has lots of opportunity for local involvement. And so I would just encourage people to jump right in and attend some of those task forces or meetings and just sort of sit and listen and sort of figure out how you might, plug in. Because that's how I started. I just started going to meetings, and eventually people put me to work. So.
Professor Amy Daly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Amy Daly for being our featured guest today.
We would also like to thank the staff of the Gettysversion and the executive board of WCBT for their ongoing support in this project. Please be sure to subscribe to On Target on Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysversion and WCBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, a senior music major focusing on composition in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Be sure to join us next week. We'll either talk to the people from the Senate Committee on Greek Life if they ever learn how to use their email, or someone else if they don't. Have a great week.